On this week's episode of Texas Scorecard Radio, our top news, Democrats announcing they're targeting 29 races in a bid to capture the Texas House. We'll also talk about a new PAC that's launching and an important retirement from the legislature. In our interview, it's week three of Plumpocalypse 2019. We've got Arif Panju with the Institute for Justice to break down Governor Abbott's illegal executive order to regulate plumbing. And finally, we'll conclude with a commentary from Empower Texans CEO Michael Quinn Sullivan. Coming to you from the 1836 studios in Austin, Texas, this is Texas Scorecard Radio. I'm your host, Tony McDonald. You can find us on the web, www.texasscorecard.com. Also, subscribe to the show. We're available on iTunes, Google Play, SoundCloud, Stitcher, and Spotify. Now, let's get started with this week's top news. For that, I've got Destin Sinski, Texas Scorecard's Capitol correspondent. Big story this week, the Democrats openly saying, hey, we've got a target of 29 districts in Texas that we're looking to win. Tell us about it.
Yeah, so Tony, this is pretty big news here because this is the first time somebody has said publicly that they've got an explicit list of Texas House districts. We saw earlier this year the DCCC targeting six congressional districts. This goes a little bit further and is a little bit more ambitious, probably the most ambitious plan we've seen detailed ahead of 2020 so far.
Yeah, and so this group, Annie's List, it's
correct,
a kind of a Democrat women's group, but they're openly saying, hey, look, we picked up these 12 seats last time. We've got another 17 that we're targeting, and it's all about control of the Texas House of Representatives.
That's right. That's right. So Annie's List is really more of a leftist organization than a women's organization because they even detailed that of these 29 districts, there's only about 20 women candidates that they think they have lined up for them. So they're more glued to their agenda, which is getting control the Texas House, making sure that there's a Democrat speaker, Democrat chairmanships appointed over these important committees, and control over the process of redistricting, which would include Texas House, Texas Senate, and most importantly, the big prize here, the congressional delegation that we send to Washington.
Yeah, so they're explicitly saying, hey, this cycle's really important because next legislative session, you're going to be doing the every decade redistricting and drawing the maps for congressional seats. It all comes back to control of Congress.
That's right.
And if you had a Democrat speaker, they would, at the very least, be able to block the legislature from passing a congressional redistricting plan that put it in the courts. The courts have traditionally drawn those very favorably to the Democrats.
That's exactly right.
It's a big prize here. Let's talk a little bit of what are they targeting? What are these 29 districts? Is it any specific place or is it all over?
Yeah, so these are, they have 12 seats that they picked up last cycle. These are included, right? They've got to defend these. Republicans have their eyes on a handful or more of those, getting them back. But 17 of them are Republican-held districts that they're targeting, and they need nine to be able to pick up the majority in the Texas House. We don't have an exact list of the precise districts and the target incumbents that they're going after here, but we do know just by kind of looking at the election data that, you know, roughly 17 or so House districts came within 10 points in the margin of victory there for Republicans last time. We think that probably constitutes the majority of the list. I'm sure there's a couple of other exceptions, some open House race, open seats and stuff like that, but no exact list, but 17 Republican-held districts.
Spread all across the state.
Mostly urban and suburban by our best guess, just looking at those those districts that came close enough last time to be able to maybe get picked up in a big wave election like last time.
Well, they're coming with a lot of money for these districts, so we'll have to keep an eye on what activity happens there and how people respond.
Yep, thanks, Tony.
Speaking of 2020, let's bring in Brandon Waltons, Texas Scorecard's Capitol Bureau Chief. New PAC being launched that, you know, might play a big role in these elections, but it's kind of unclear. Tell us about it.
Yes, Joe Strauss. Remember him? He's back, former Speaker of the Texas House, trying to launch himself back into the political sphere, starting a new PAC, the Texas Forever Forward PAC, and starting it out with $2.5 million from his former campaign's coffers.
Yeah, and so sitting on a bunch of money, puts it into this PAC. Mm-hmm. What do we know about this PAC and what role it intends to play, and what role Strauss intends to play in in this election cycle.
Well, you know, it's early. He put out a statement when he created this, when he launched it, saying that they would, I'm looking at the quote here, they would promote a thoughtful approach to governing and rising political leaders, blah, blah, blah. Sort of your typical boiler language there. But you look at the priorities that he lays out, a lot of it's just veiled words for more state spending, for more, they call them business-friendly policies that are inclusive, essentially means pro-LGBTQ AI policies. And so looks like they're going to be involved in the state Texas elections in 2020.
Yeah, but it's unclear. Obviously, the Democrats are coming in. We've talked about these 29 districts that they're aiming at. You know, you would think, okay, if he's going to defend Republican leaders, pro-business, that kind of thing,
he'd say.
I feel like they would say it, right?
Well, and that's the thing. And you look at it, at his track record, because after he announced that he was not going to be running for re-election, Joe Strauss is sitting on almost $8 million in his campaign's war chest. You look at the 2018 election, and you had a lot of Republicans up against tough races against Democrats.
Some of his former allies.
Exactly. I mean,
there's people who had stood by him as Speaker in tough elections last cycle.
And he did little to nothing to try to help them fight back against that, did not use that money for it, instead held on to it. So he's got nearly $8 million. He puts $2.5 million towards this effort. The question is he talking about electing more Republicans or more Democrats?
Yeah, is this, and it's unclear. Is this going to be for trying to elect more liberal Republicans in the primaries? Is it to defend Republicans in November? Maybe. I mean, he's ostensibly a Republican, right? Or is it, you know, to help Democrats? It's really unclear at this point.
Exactly. I mean, when you look at his time, we of course know when he was in the Texas House, constantly an obstructionist for conservative policies, you know, pro-gun, pro-life reforms in the Texas House. You'd have to expect that his PAC is probably going to be choosing and supporting candidates that align with that history that he has there.
Yeah, and so that could be any number of things, Democrats, Republicans, or, you know, both.
Exactly. Could be involved in the general election, could be involved in the primary. I guess we'll find out pretty shortly here when campaign finance reports are released.
Finally, let's turn to Carrie Cheshire, Vice President for Texans for Fiscal Responsibility. A big story this week, a major retirement from the legislature.
That's right, Tony. State Representative Jonathan Stickland of Hearst Euless Bedford up by the DFW airport announced he would not seek another term in the Texas legislature. And grassroots Texans all across are kind of all across the state are recognizing that it's probably going to be a pretty big loss for the Texas legislature.
Yeah, so this is a guy who, a conservative stalwart, standout in the legislature. I think the question that's raised is, you know, is there going to be a void if he's no longer there?
Well, I think that's a big question. You know, Jonathan Stickland was the one who was willing to do what other lawmakers were not in the Texas House. He was one of the biggest fighters against the Joe Strauss regime, constantly calling point of orders on bills, constantly killing bills on the local and consent calendar that were not things that most Texans would probably want to pass, and fearlessly advocating for conservative issues. Issues like constitutional carry was his number one issue. He did this session get a monumental bill across the finish line in banning red light cameras all across the state.
Yeah, it's interesting. I've had Jonathan on the show before, and it's interesting the things that he would do in the legislature were, you know, not necessarily always high profile, but were very important. These nitty-gritty things of just straight up calling for a record vote so that whenever there was some issue going on, maybe with a major amendment vote, that lawmakers would have to go on the record so where people would see where they stand, things like that. Things like you mentioned, the local and consent calendar. You know, the question is anybody going to step up to fill these voids in the future?
Well, and it's fill these voids both inside and outside of the building. You know, Jonathan Stickland was a leader for grassroots Texans in election season, going around helping recruit candidates, helping them organize their campaigns and win election to the Texas legislature. There's a number of lawmakers in the Texas House and even in the Texas Senate that would not be there today if it weren't for Jonathan Stickland helping and organizing people on their behalf. And he was a constant source of energy for organizations like the Northeast Tarrant Tea Party, where he was recruited to run for office by
That's
its
right.
leader, Julie McCarty, and other grassroots organizations all across the state. The important thing, I think, for folks to remember is that what Jonathan Stickland did is something that almost anyone could do. I mean, here you literally have a guy who had a GED, operated a pest control company, just a regular average Joe who decided, you know, those knuckleheads aren't doing a good job. I can do better myself. And won election to the Texas House and was kind of the tip of the spear for conservative reform.
Yeah, so I guess the answer really, if you look at the legislature and say, okay, we're going to miss this Stickland guy, well, then you recognize, you know, you could do the things that he's doing. That means you need to run, or like Julie McCarty, recruit somebody who will fill the void in your district.
Well, that's absolutely right, Tony.
Texas Scorecard Radio is a project of Empower Texans. At texasscorecard.com or empowertexans.com, you can find more news and daily updates from all around the Lone Star State. You can also find updates from Empower Texans and Texas Scorecard on Facebook and Twitter, and follow Empower Texans on Instagram. Texas Scorecard's News Digest goes out weekly via email and monthly in print. Subscribe online and find more information at empowertexans.com. Someone's always keeping score. We think it ought to be the taxpayers.
Well, it's great to welcome on the program this week Arif Panju with Institute for Justice. Arif, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
You know, I wanted to have you in. We are in week three here of what I've started to call Plumpocalypse 2019, right? The imminent unlicensed plumbing coming to the state of Texas, the governor taking swift emergency action to stop the plumbing ninjas from attacking us without licenses, and taking this executive order. We've talked a little bit about it on the program in the last 2 weeks, but I wanted to have you in. You're an expert, not just on occupational licensing, but as an attorney on these separation of powers issues involved, and wanted to get your take on what's going on here. So I guess I'll ask a big, broad question, top-end question. The action that Governor Abbott has taken on the plumbing board, is it legal?
Well, I think we know that the legislature has the power to pass laws and to sunset laws. The governor can't do either. And, you know, in the state of Texas, we have an express provision in our Constitution, Article 2, Section 1, Separation of Powers Clause. And it's pretty clear, and it's not ambiguous. It says that the power of government is divided into three branches, and, quote, each of which shall be confided to a separate body. And the legislative one does legislative work, and the executive does not. And so here we basically have a plumbing licensing law that is on the books only because the governor exercised his power. If he hadn't done so, there would be no statute on the books. And the legislature's delegation of emergency powers can't be construed to allow the governor to keep laws on the books that the legislature has made clear would not be on the books, and certainly not those that they've recently considered and let sunset. And so this is a problem. It's a problem involving the separation of powers, and something that, unfortunately, that all Texans have to be seriously concerned about, and members of the legislature should be concerned about.
Yeah, so let's, for listeners who maybe haven't been following along, we kind of recap here. Texas has regulated plumbing like it regulates all kind of professions, and that law by its own natural terms expired, or was set to expire, in September of this year because the legislature could not reach an agreement about how to extend the law. And so Governor Abbott has come in with this executive order saying, hey, I'm going to use my emergency powers because of Hurricane Harvey from a couple of years ago. I'm going to use my emergency powers under the law to suspend the part of the law that says this law expires. And so it's still going to be on the books, and we're going to continue to enforce it for another 2 years. Is there even a counter argument? What is the devil's advocate argument? I mean, are they? Can you even give voice to how this would be justified?
I mean, I think from a constitutional standpoint, the governor believes that he has extremely broad powers, and the executive has broad powers, but those powers have to respect the design that the Constitution has provided. And so, you know, for example, in this case, the governor claims that he can use Texas Government Code 418.016, suspension of certain laws and rules. And that's a law that says the governor may suspend the provisions of any regulatory statute that prescribes the procedures of conduct of state business. Procedures of conduct of state business. He's interpreted that to mean that he can suspend the sunsetting provision of laws to keep laws on the books that, but for his executive action, would not be on the books. That's legislating.
Yeah.
That's keeping laws on the books. And so as a matter of constitutional law, this is problematic. As a matter of policy, this is a head-scratcher. The governor's own commission, post-Harvey, it's called the Commission to Rebuild Texas, issued a report in November and cited shortages in some building trades, and including, quote, particularly plumbers.
Oh, my gosh.
As an, quote, ongoing problem, and concluded that affected property owners, quote, struggled to find legitimate skilled tradespeople to help them rebuild after Hurricane Harvey. And, of course, the Sunset Commission found that the plumbing board, which is controlled by licensed plumbers, imposed a litany of constraints on plumbers that has created a shortage, and that these unnecessary burdens have exasperated the shortage. So it's transparently illogical to say, hey, there's a problem with rebuilding. We need more plumbers. And we understand that there's a shortage of plumbers, and that the Sunset Commission has provided evidence that that's due to licensing and unreasonable burdens and unnecessary burdens created by licensing. And so we're going to double down on licensing because we want to help the people that are recovering. It doesn't make any sense.
It's turning the entire thing on its head. It sounds like to me we have this provision, and I think there's a lot of debate out there about whether these suspension of laws for a disaster or an emergency. Obviously, there's been a lot of discussion about President Trump's action with the wall and wall funding and stuff like that. There's been a robust debate in legal circles about that action. Here you have something, you have a provision in law, and you know, even if you say, okay, maybe it's fine that we have a suspending privilege in the law for the governor, it's to your exact point, it's about trying to get hurdles out of the way of people who need to rush into an area during an emergency to take action and fix things. Where government is a barrier to solving the problem, you can remove the barrier is the logic. Here he's saying, okay, I'm going to use this power to then legislate a barrier that's going to get in people's way.
You're absolutely right. So earlier, closer to when Harvey actually took place, post-Harvey, the governor suspended a whole slew of regulations. Laws that were on the books were suspended under this power, suspension of certain laws and rules, Texas Government Code. And they were regulations that were suspended because you didn't want all this red tape wrapping the hands of people who were trying to rebuild. When that was over, the laws remained on the books. Here, he's not suspending a law. He's resurrecting an entire statute that would not exist. That's fundamentally different. And he's not just resurrecting a statute. He's resurrecting barriers to entry into an occupation that have created the very shortages that he's invoking for the executive order.
Yeah.
And so, this would seem to exasperate Hurricane Harvey recovery efforts, which is, again, the very basis of the executive order. So we have two issues. One, extremely bad policy outcome, where you've got basically rent seekers, licensed lobbyists who are lobbying hard to keep their barriers to entry, claiming that there's no regulation, even though their work product is heavily regulated at the local level. And you have a constitutional issue at this point because you've got the governor exercising his power to resurrect a statute that would not exist anymore but for his executive action. That's fundamentally different than suspending temporarily a law that will be on the books when that suspension is over.
Yeah, it's really amazing. Obviously, there's a political element to this whole thing. It appears the governor is afraid to call a special session you could pass in a couple of days in a special session a bill to renew these regulations, put these statutes back on the books. That's not a huge lift politically. Obviously, the governor doesn't want to do that for various reasons. I would speculate because there would be pressure to put
important political conservative reforms on the agenda, which is bizarre that he's avoiding that. But you have, you know, you have this group, and it's interesting. It's the plumbers themselves who are rallying and campaigning, saying not only do they want this executive order, but they or maybe they don't even want that. They want the regulations in place. So he's trying to placate one political group without opening himself up to an opportunity to placate others. It's very bizarre, but I mean, you see in this what goes on with every licensing regime, which is that the people in the industry want to use these things to control and block out their competition.
Yeah, that's right, and that's not, you know, our conclusion solely. It's also the conclusion of the Sunset Advisory Commission. Plenty of lawmakers who are fully aware that these licensed plumbers want a barrier to entry. And you're absolutely right. It's unsurprising that it's plumbers, not consumers, who were frantically trying to save the licensing board after the ledge let it sunset. Because, you know, thwarting competition is hard to defend publicly. And so instead, the licensed plumbers resort to scaremongering, and that resulted in the governor prompting first a tweet saying, "We're going to take care of this," and then issuing an executive order.
Yeah.
Now, the problem here, and, you know, if just last week, Justice Gorsuch, in a case on June 20th, in a case named Gundy v. United States, said, quote, "There can be no liberty where the legislative and executive powers are united in the same person." And like I said earlier, the legislature can pass and sunset laws, but the governor cannot do either. And this executive order simply doubles down on an anti-competitive licensing board that's controlled by market participants that want a barrier to entry. And unfortunately, it's Texans, including those affected by Hurricane Harvey, who will bear the cost.
Yeah,
you know, there's many states. There's half a dozen states, including a big state like New York, that don't license plumbers at the state level. And here in Texas, yeah, plumbers are already heavily regulated. You need government permission to get a permit. You need government's permission before your plan is signed off. Government scrutinizes your work product while it's ongoing through inspections, and scrutinizes it when you're done. And the idea that it's unregulated without a state license, which is really a barrier to entry, is incoherent.
Yeah,
regulations that are tailored.
So you already have, and these can be problematic too, but you already have local regulation that says we're going to regulate the work product that's being done. The state regulation is truly about controlling who is the pool of people who can provide this service. So it's really purely attached to this concept of blocking out and boxing out competition. You know, you were just raising the point from Gundy, the separation of powers issue. I think people don't appreciate how important these distinctions are, because we have this beautiful system where the people's representatives say what the law is, they make the laws, the people in the executive branch, the governor on down, who actually move forward in enforcing the regulations, they don't get to make the regulations. They don't get to decide what it is they're going to enforce. And in fact, they have to agree that, you know, the law is legitimate in order to enforce it. So, you know, you have this hard break between the making of the law and the enforcing of the law. And then at the end of the day, if they really want to enforce something, they have to take you to a court and they have to put you in front of a jury, and the people, your neighbors, have to sign off on punishing you for not being in compliance. So it's these, I wish people would appreciate how important these distinctions and silos really are.
Yeah, the separation of powers is designed to protect individual liberty. I mean, the tension even within the legislative branch is designed to make it difficult to pass laws. And so when the board sunset, it sunsets. And whether the executive branch office holder, and right now it's Governor Abbott, disagrees with that, or, you know, believes that the plumbers need to be rescued because, you know, the plumbers and no one else are really worried about their licensing law. Governor doesn't get to just say, you know what, I'll just disregard what the legislature said. And what they said here is that unless continued in existence as provided by this chapter, the board is abolished and the chapter expires September 1st, 2019. That's clear. And what we have here is a suspension of that provision to keep a law on the books. That's quite different than suspending a regulation that will remain on the books And it's from a policy standpoint, this doesn't make any sense because it does the exact opposite of the justification that's being advanced to do so in the first instance.
Yeah, it's just to me a totally illegal, totally unconstitutional action and very illogical and improper action. We're running out of time. Tell folks, I mean, y'all do such great work with Institute for Justice litigating cases, you know, like the kind of cases that might come out of this sort of thing. So if people want to learn more about the work you're doing and any developments on this stuff, how can they connect with you?
They can go to www.ij.org, Institute for Justice, so ij.org. And, you know, if you're a business owner in Texas and you'd like to hire competent people that can perform plumbing services but run into this licensing scheme, or would like to do more things within their career as plumbers but are stuck with a journeyman license and have to work 4,000 hours before they can get the master plumbing license, this affects you. Because but for the executive order, you'd be able to do both. Hire people that don't have the government's permission slip, because there won't be one that's necessary. Or if you're competent, not have to go through additional hoops to do work that you know how to do. We'd love to hear from folks like that, so let us know. You know, we'd like to hear how licensing laws affect people. And so if folks want to get in touch with us, you go to our website and give us a ring.
Great, great. IJ.org, great organization. Thank you for joining us, Arif.
Thank you very much.
Sometimes the enemies of freedom will come onto the battlefield like giants, but history tells us exactly what we're to do whenever we're squaring off against a giant. Empower Texans CEO Michael Quinn Sullivan tells us more about that in this week's commentary.
Not too long ago, I was standing in a dry creek bed in Israel, where a giant, a fearsome soldier, was killed with a rock. I'm Michael Quinn Sullivan with the Texas Scorecard Radio Commentary. So there I was in the Valley of Elah. The rumbling of trucks along a nearby Israeli highway made the spot remind me of the land my grandparents owned outside Wichita Falls along a busy farm-to-market road. Nothing remarkable about either place. Except, of course, that's where David killed the Philistine giant Goliath. The rumble of the trucks couldn't compare with what I imagined was the collective shouts of dismay as a slight young shepherd took out the warrior giant. The antiseptic story we're told in Sunday school ends with David using a slingshot to pop Goliath in the head. But not so fast. 1 Samuel 17 goes into far more detail. You see, David stepped up when King Saul and his soldiers were unwilling to face Goliath. We learn it wasn't the stone that killed Goliath, but rather David, quote, took hold of the Philistine sword and drew it from the sheath. After he killed him, he cut off the head with a sword. But the story doesn't end there. The Philistine army was shocked by the death of their unconquerable warrior, so they turned tail and ran. Rather than call it a day, the Israelites pursued and killed the Philistines, leaving their bodies, quote, strewn along the road to Gath and Ekron, end quote. Then the victorious Israelites came back and plundered the Philistines' encampment. Standing in that dry creek bed, I picked up several smooth rocks and thought of the impossibility of using one to slay a giant. Take out a massive hulk of man who has spent his life training as a warrior, cloaked in shields, with a small rock? Yeah, right. It's impossible. Impossible, that is, right up until the moment it happens. Of course, Goliath wasn't actually killed by the stone. He was killed by his own sword, wielded by a bold David. And then chasing an army to their death? That's hot, sweaty, dirty, and bloody work. Very often, the giants we face in life and politics and business seem impossible to defeat. Yet history is replete with impossible giants being vanquished. We simply must have faith that the stone in our hand will be guided by the Almighty to the right spot. We must act faithfully and boldly, and sometimes even get our hands dirty. We must also be faithfully committed to the work of winning. Too often we accept half victories that end up as little more than a prelude to our own defeat. The Israelites didn't walk away after Goliath was vanquished. They pursued their enemies. In the same way, we must be committed to getting the job done and done completely. Let's go slay some giants and pursue our enemies to the gates of Ekron. We can't count on kings to do our work for us. It's up to us as a self-governing people to faithfully get the job done. With a Texas Scorecard Radio Commentary, I'm Michael Quinn Sullivan.
Well, that's all I have for you this week. If you enjoyed the show, I'd encourage you to go to texasscorecard.com. We've got articles going up there on a daily basis from writers like Brandon, Dustin, and Carrie. You can also subscribe to our monthly print publication. That's right. Get Texas Scorecard to your mailbox every month in print. I hope you enjoy.
Texas Scorecard Radio is brought to you each week as a public service from the Empower Texans Foundation and in partnership with the Lincoln Institute and this station. You can download podcasts from each program and learn more at empowertexans.com.